Just finding a relaxing and comfortable posture just to settle back. And what I'd like to reflect on this evening is freedom and the second arrow. So, this being human isn't easy. We're subject to sickness, aging, to death. Things we enjoy, things we hold dear, cease, come to an end. We lose them. Things we actually don't wish to happen in our lives happen. And this body mind is highly sensitive. It's impacted by the world and others through our senses. But also, it's vulnerable. It's vulnerable to change, to injury, to stress. And the Buddha referred to this aspect of our experience as dukkha. Dukkha is quite an interesting word. We usually translate it as suffering. But it's actually much more subtle than that. The root of the word is actually more to do with an ill-fitting axle in a wheel. This sense that when the axle is ill-fitting in a wheel and you're in a cart, it's going to be a very bumpy, rough journey, an uncomfortable journey. And that's a bit what our lives are like. Things arise in our experience that are uncomfortable, that we experience as unpleasant, as challenging, as difficult. And we have a certain way of engaging with that. And this is where the Buddha, if you like, very much started his teaching. His very first, or what is reputed to be his very first teaching to six former colleagues he'd practiced with, called The Turning of the Wheel of the Dharma, starts from this basis of what's since become known as actually the Four Noble Truths. But actually, this is quite a misleading way that it's become known. Because what was interesting about this first teaching that the Buddha talked about was actually he gave us a set of tasks to perform and to complete. And it's actually in completing those tasks that he considered himself awake. So the Buddha started from this understanding that this discomfort with life is part of the human condition. It's not all that life is. He acknowledges that joy and pleasure and the beautiful is also a part of life. But actually, it's this aspect, this dukkha, that causes us so much difficulty. And the task he gave us in relation to dukkha is to fully comprehend it, to fully know it and fully understand it in our experience. And I like Stephen Batchelor talks about this as embracing life. And I like that way of thinking of it, of how we are called to embrace, to meet the entirety of our lives. As I've been talking about, nothing left out, nothing excluded. Even though at times that can be very, very challenging. So, this aspect of dukkha, the Buddha actually divided into three types. The dukkha of pain. So aging, sickness, injury, mental pain that comes from loss and grief of what's very dear to us. This, in a sense, is inescapable. Christina Feldman talks about these as the unarguables. They're just part of life. He then talked about dukkha that arises from impermanence. So the fact that things change, that things arise in our lives that we don't like out of change. Pleasant experiences that we have will also cease and come to an end due to change. That actually change itself brings a certain level of dukkha, of discomfort. But we can learn to relate to change in a way that it doesn't cause the same degree of dukkha. And the final, the most subtle level is the dukkha of conditionality. That actually all experience, all life arises dependent on conditions. That there's no ground to our experience. Nothing we can rest on as being the ultimate, this is where I can find safety and security. And how this can cause a certain level of unease in our lives, even though we may not actually be very conscious of seeing the world through this way. But again, we can also learn to rest in a way of being with this conditioned nature of experience, of life, of the world. In a way that it doesn't need to cause us so much difficulty, so much stress. We can actually start to gain some freedom here as well. So we start from this point of dukkha. And the Buddha talked about arising from this dukkha, there is craving. Now, again, the word that Buddha actually used was tanha, which we translate as craving, but a more literal translation is thirst. And I love that. It really conjures this image for me, this image of a person wandering across a desert without water, and how that thirst starts to build. And when that thirst becomes strong enough, on the horizon, there's a tendency to see a pool of water. And when they make their way to that pool of water, they discover that it was a mirage, an illusion. And we're a bit like this in relation to dukkha. We have strategies of trying to hold on to what's we deem as pleasant in our life, or trying to actually engineer our life in a way that actually we have as much pleasant experience as possible. And at the same time, this habit of wanting to push away and get rid of what's difficult, what's unpleasant in our life, and trying to avoid this aspect of our life. But what we start to discover when we do this is that actually it doesn't bring us what it is we hope for. It too is an illusion and a mirage that these habitual ways of push-pull with life, of pulling towards ourselves pleasant experiences and pushing away unpleasant experiences, actually ties us to them. Actually brings another level of stress and discomfort into our lives. And the Buddha talked about this as through the parable of the second arrow. So he talked about, or he asked his disciples, what's the difference between an uninstructed run-of-the-mill person, so someone like myself, and a well-instructed disciple? And he pointed out that both will experience pleasant experiences and painful experiences. And the analogy he used was that the uninstructed run-of-the-mill person, it's like they're hit by a first arrow, that first arrow being the immediacy of pain, of discomfort, of the difficult. And immediately they're hit by a second arrow. And this second arrow is that push-pull, that reaction against what's arising. And that second arrow is another second layer of dukkha. We might actually talk about it as being optional. It's something we actually bring into the equation at that point. Whereas the instructed, the well-instructed disciple will also experience that first arrow, but they won't experience that second arrow. So what the Buddha is starting to point towards here is that freedom is not about avoiding the unpleasant, the painful, the difficult. This is just a part of what it is to be human. That freedom actually comes from not adding a second, and actually what we often do is add a third, fourth, and fifth arrow, that we can really start to spin our experience and really create a lot of additional stress and discomfort, tension in our lives. So what we have is we develop these strategies, this thirst for life to be other than it is, this thirst for a pleasant life, a life of pleasure, a life of ease, and a thirst for an avoidance of what is difficult, what is challenging, what actually causes us discomfort in life. So the task in relation to this tanha, this craving, is to let go, which actually proves to be much more difficult than a simple task of letting go. I don't know if you've noticed in your experience, but actually consciously deciding to let go doesn't seem to work very well. In a sense, we can't just choose to let go. But what we do start to find is we can start to allow, to let be, to welcome. And it's this allowing, this letting be, this welcome, in conjunction with beginning to understand this process of dukkha and the craving of push-pull with the dukkha, that can start to loosen and release some of that habitual tendency to be in conflict with life. We can start to actually notice the habitual patterns we have and actually at times consciously choose not to go there. I notice this myself in my own practice. One of the things, like many people I've struggled with over the years, has been a tendency towards self-criticism and self-judgment. And what I started to notice over the years, that when I start to notice that happening, starting maybe to criticize and overthink how I did on a particular talk, let's say, to a group such as this, I can see that if I can catch it in time, I know where it's going to lead. I know the suffering it's going to bring into my life. And there are times when I can consciously decide that I'm just not going to go there. I'm not going to do that to myself. So I have that initial dukkha of maybe not being satisfied with how I performed at something, or that sense of actually that habitual energy of not being good enough coming up. But in seeing that and knowing that if I pursue that and I add that second arrow and the third arrow and the fourth arrow, that I'm really going to create a lot of additional pain and suffering for myself. And in beginning to understand it and see it, more and more being able to actually decide that I'm not going to do that to myself, that I'm actually not going to go down that self-critical way. Now, I might actually analyze how I performed and what went well and what didn't well, but I can then do it from a much more wholesome place, a way which is much more constructive rather than destructive. So, what we can see here is the flow into the third task, the third statement the Buddha made. And he talked about Nibbana, the extinguishing or the putting out. So, what gets extinguished or put out is the fire of greed, hatred, or delusion. In other words, the reactivity of craving. When we can actually let go of that reactivity as it arises, what we find is a space opens up for us. And I alluded to this space this morning when I referenced Viktor Frankl. And I can find it here. Oops, I think it might be here. Oh, yeah. I'll give a more full quote of what he actually said. Between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space lies our freedom and power to choose our response. In our response lies our growth and freedom. So, when we can step out of that habitual push-pull with life, when we can release our reactivity, we find ourselves in this space between stimulus and response rather than reaction. And there's the possibility of choosing a different way of responding that isn't habitual, that actually meets the situation as it's arising, but also meets it from a much more intuitive space, a space that actually is full of kindness and care and a certain natural wisdom. And the task in relation to this space, this nibbanic space, is to know it, to actually start to become familiar with it, to actually start to become familiar with the freedom that is possible in that space when we're not driven by habit, when we're not driven by that craving, that push-pull with life. And from that space, what arises is the possibility to cultivate a path, a life. A word that is used quite a lot now in Dharmic circles is flourishing, that we can actually start to flourish as a person. So this path the Buddha talked about as the Noble Eightfold Path or the Ennobling Eightfold Path. And our task in relation to this is to bring it into being, to cultivate it. And this path starts with wise view. The Buddha understands or understood that actually what we value, what we hold as important in life, what our views and our opinions and beliefs are part of what shapes our experience. So he pointed to certain ways of seeing the world that are really supportive to actually a life that flourishes. One is to cultivate and bring into being the wholesome and to release and let go of the unwholesome. And this wholesome and unwholesome isn't a binary good bad. What the Buddha's pointing to here is the wholesome is what leads to well-being, that leads to a lessening of that stress, that second arrow in our life. What leads to our flourishing and what leads to bringing benefit and well-being to others. The unwholesome has the opposite impact. It's what actually increases dukkha, so brings into being the second arrow. What leads to a decrease in well-being and actually brings harm to ourselves, to others, to the world. And it's quite interesting. I heard Ajahn Suchito talking about this a little while ago. He talked about how the unwholesome is by nature unwhole. It leads to fracturing, to falling apart. By its nature, it falls apart itself. But also in terms of actually our experience, it leads to a falling apart of well-being, of wholeness within our sense of ourselves. Whereas the wholesome is by nature whole, and it leads to a sense of wholeness, a sense of connection, and a sense of non-separation. A second aspect that the Buddha talked about that's really important is the idea that actions have consequences. How we think, how we speak, how we act in the world will have consequences for ourselves and for others. So to tread lightly, to actually tread from that perspective of actually non-harming, of care. And then the third aspect was or is three characteristics. And there's an interesting sutta where a monk who is ill asks the Buddha to come visit him. And the Buddha asks him a series of questions around hoping that his symptoms are improving and he's feeling like things are getting better. And the monk says, no, he thinks things are getting worse. He hopes he's not feeling too anxious and overwhelmed by it. And the monk replies, well, actually, I'm feeling quite anxious and quite overwhelmed. And the Buddha asks him, well, how about your sense of your virtue? And the monk says, well, actually, I feel okay about my virtue. So the Buddha says, well, then what is there to be concerned about? And the monk talks about how actually he's no longer able to meditate in a way that he was formerly able to meditate, to actually have the same degree of concentration. And he was concerned that he would actually fall back in his practice. And the Buddha pointed to the fact that actually this was not a helpful way to think of things, that actually all experience is impermanent, it's inconstant, subject to change. If what we're depending on is being able to have a certain experience, an experience of concentration, or an experience of emptiness, or any kind of spiritual experience, then actually we are going to cause difficulty for ourselves because all experience will change. All experience ultimately is unsatisfactory. And what the Buddha means by that is not that actually we don't have satisfaction in pleasant experiences in our lives, but that actually there's no experience that can bring us lasting satisfaction. That ultimately everything changes and comes to an end, so we can never find lasting satisfaction. But also, the flip side of that is also true. We can never have an experience that brings lasting dissatisfaction. Any experience we have will change. So we will never have an experience that brings us lasting dissatisfaction. And finally, he pointed to the fact that if our experience is constant, changing, and actually unsatisfactory, can we actually rely on it as being me and mine? Is there any experience we can have that we can comfortably say, this is me or this is mine? And he actually pointed to the fact that this is not the case. That actually, when we view our experience through these lenses, not as truths, but actually as experiential ways of knowing our experience, that our experience changes, and we're in tune with that change. That actually we can't hold on to any experience to bring us lasting satisfaction or dissatisfaction. And there's no aspect of our experience, nothing we can know in our experience that we can ultimately say is me or mine. That it's all a flow, a flux, a process of changing identity, changing sense of self moment by moment, arising and passing. And when we can start to tune into those ways of looking at the world, we can actually start to think about creating a path based in harmlessness, based in understanding impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not self, that then flows into our life and how we speak and how we act, but also in how we support ourselves in using the resources of the world. And that mindful attention and how we direct our energies, so wise mindfulness and wise effort, support us in actually bringing into being what it is we value in the world. And It's this coming together, this coalescing, this focusing of our life in this way that brings a certain degree of what the Buddha called samadhi, of collectedness, of composure. So collectedness, composure, samadhi isn't about being concentrated. It's actually about collecting all our energies, all our sense of who or what we are in any moment together in the pursuit of a flourishing life that brings well-being to ourselves, to others, and to the world. That's very much rooted in non-harming. So, we could think of the path of practice as the cultivation of a life where we meet the whole of our experience. We're willing to actually open to the full breadth of what it is to be a human being. Releasing that tendency of the push-pull, the reactivity with what we find difficult and wanting to hold on to what we find pleasant. To actually not adding that second arrow and that third arrow. But that itself, in a sense, is the point of freedom. When we don't add that second and third arrow, then possibility arises. The possibility in that space, that nibbanic space, to choose a response, to choose a response that actually cultivates what it is we value, we hold most dear in the world and in our lives. To flourish as a human being within the particularity and the specificity of our life as it is, moment by moment. So, I'd like to finish with a little poem that speaks a bit to this. It's called Unconditional by Jennifer Wellwood. Willing to experience aloneness, I discover connection everywhere. Turning to face my fear, I meet the warrior who lives within. Opening to my loss, I gain the embrace of the universe. Surrendering into emptiness, I find fullness without end. Each condition I flee from pursues me. Each condition I welcome transforms me and becomes itself transformed into its radiant jewel-like essence. So practice calls us to embrace the wholeness of our lives, but also within that, to very much take this as a practice rooted in patience, but also the wisdom of what we can and cannot do in any moment. So practice, although it calls us to meet our experience as it is, as it arises moment by moment, also needs to be tempered by the wisdom of knowing what we have the capability, the capacity to hold in any moment. If we turn to something and it overwhelms us, all we do is, in a sense, re-trigger any trauma, any habitual way of reacting to it. It's just reinforced. So there's also the wisdom within this turning towards this meeting and this embracing of life, of knowing when to back off, when to actually say, all right, I need to actually turn the attention elsewhere to resource and nourish the being. So that may be turning the attention to another aspect of the experience where we can find some self-regulation, some balance, maybe some sense of nourishment. So I've talked about this aspect of grounding, of turning the attention to a part of our experience, a part of our body, which is actually more neutral or more comfortable, more at ease. It may actually mean that we need to consciously, distract isn't quite the right word, but consciously decide that actually I need to put this aside right now and do something else that nourishes me. Whether that's go take a rest, go talk to a friend, go for a walk in nature, whatever it is that actually can bring some sense of stability and well-being again. So that actually we have the capacity to again turn to that experience. And we often refer to this as titration, this movement towards playing its edge. And then noticing when it's actually we're starting to become overwhelmed, unbalanced, and then backing off again, resourcing, nourishing the being. And then when we're ready again, we can start to turn towards it. So again, even though we talk about something like the warrior spirit, the warrior also knows when it's time to back off, to retreat, to recoup and regather, self-regulate, nourish, so that again they can turn towards and meet what is challenging. And this is a practice in itself of knowing and learning where our edges are. So gradually, over time, with patience, we're able to hold more and more of our experience without rejection, without being overwhelmed, and without moving into that push-pull of reactivity and adding those second, third, and fourth arrows. So, thank you for your attention.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.